the forest floor. Another damned vole. She watched it pause, tilt its head back, and loose another curdling shriek. A short time later, she'd left the voracious things behind. The huge boles of the trees thinned out, with more undergrowth now impeding her way. She caught glimpses of the sky, a sweep of stars, no moon. A dozen paces ahead, the ground fell away. She came to the edge, looked down into a ravine crowded with treefall, the trunks grey as bones. Clumps of low fog wandered the length of the channel, glowing like swamp gas. The channel was the product of flash flooding, and those trees had been savagely uprooted, flung down and carried along in the tumult. Studying the wreckage, she caught a shape in the ravine's gloom, 20 or so paces downstream. At first, she'd assumed it was a barrier of knotted branches and trees, but that detritus had fetched up against something else, a hull. She drew out the splinter of wood in her belt. It seemed to be sweating in her hand. Boots skidding, she half slid, half stumbled down the steep bank of the ravine. Avoiding the fog as best she could, she clambered and climbed her way closer to the ship. How it had made it this far down this treacherous winding channel without being torn to pieces was something of a mystery, but she knew enough to trust this sorcerous link. Whatever shape it was in, there would be enough of it to be of some use. At last, she reached the hull, set her hand against it. Not rotten. She thumped it, was rewarded with a faint hollow sound. 5 arm spans above her was an ornately carved gunwale, the heavy rail formed in the shape of entwining serpents running the length of the ship, which she judged to be somewhere between 15 and 20 paces. She glanced down then to see the fog rising up to swallow her knees, and in that fog small clawed hands reached out to grasp her thighs, the talons stabbing deep, the limbs writhing like worms. Gasping at the pain, she pulled out her sword and began hacking. Her thighs were shredded and streaming blood by the time she cut herself loose and worked her way up the side of the hull, using the clutter of trees and branches for foot and handholds. Gasping, she lifted herself over the gunwale and thumped down on the slanted deck, and found herself in the midst of a squall of black-haired, scaled apes. Howling, the dog-sized creatures bared dagger-long fangs, eyes flashing lurid yellow, and raised their knotted clubs. Then they rushed her. From somewhere up the length of ravine, there came a deep, rumbling roar. But she had no time to think about that. "My Utulu thinks this is sex. How strange." Falash glanced sidelong at the captain, her lids slowly settling in a lazy blink. "Back in the palace, there are exquisite mouthpieces carved in the semblance of a penis." She gestured with one hand. "All part of a princess's education." Shurik set the mouthpiece down. "Enough of that, I think, Highness. I leave you to your devices." "Adventure arrives in all manner of guises, Captain. Had your Utulu a brain, I am sure it would most avidly concur." "But that's the whole point about, desire. It's mostly brainless. Most of the world's tragedy is found in this one misunderstanding. We tie too much to it, you see. Things like loyalty and precious intimacy, love and possession, and sooner or later it all goes wrong. Why, I knew men, and I do mean new, who'd come to me twice a week hungry for the brainless stuff, and afterwards they'd babble on about their wives."
"What would they tell you? Please, I must know."
"Starved for gossip, are you?"
"The palace seems terribly far away at the moment."
"Just so, Highness. Well, some would tell me about all the sorcery of love being gone between them, the embers of desire cold as stone now. Others would complain about how complicated it had all become, or how rote, or how fraught. And still more would talk of their wives as if they were possessions, to be used when it suited the men, and otherwise left alone. But the very notion of those wives perhaps doing what the husband happened to be doing, there with me, well, that could light a murderous rage in their eyes."
So, while being with you, most of them still missed the point?
Very astute, Highness. Yes, they missed the point entirely.
Because what you offered was sex without complications.
Exactly.
Brainless.
Yes. And that freed them, and freedom made them happy, or anyway forgetful, at least for a short time. But once the flush was passed, well, that old world and all its chains just came rattling back down. They'd leave as if they were condemned to swim the canal.
You have led a varied and extraordinary life, Captain.
Life? Wrong word, Highness.
Oh, one doesn't have to be breathing to be alive. And before you comment on how ridiculously obvious that statement seems, I do implore you to give it a second consideration, as I was not referring to your condition.
Then I am indeed curious as to what you might mean, Highness.
In my years of education, I have...
A roar drowned out her next words, and they swung round to see a torrent of muddy, foaming water pounding into the bay just beyond the shallows. Rushing from a gaping wound almost swallowed in gouts of steam, the flood thundered aside the slabs of floating ice, clearing a broad swath. A moment later, what seemed half a forest exploded out from the wound, snapped branches and sundered trees. And then the prow of a ship lunged into view, outward like a thrust fist, and then plunging down to the bay's churning waters. The raucous flow drove the ship straight for the reef.
"Erin's bitch!" swore Shurkelal.
Abruptly, in wallows of spume and steam, the ship heeled, came about, and they saw a figure at the stern rudder, pushing hard against the current. The wound thundered shut, cutting off the wild flow. Branches and logs skirled in the spinning water. Falash watched the captain run into the shallows. The strange ship had crunched briefly against the coral shelf before pulling clear. It was fortunate, the princess decided, that the seas were calm, but it was obvious that one woman alone could not manage the craft, and that disaster still loomed. Glancing to the right, she saw the crew pelting along the strand, clearly intent on joining the captain. Falash looked back to the ship.
"Dearie, couldn't you have found a prettier one?"
Spitting out silty water, Shurkelal pulled herself onto the deck. Something slimy beneath her boots sent her down onto her backside with a thump. She held up one palm. Blood. Lots and lots of blood. Swearing, she regained her feet and made for the bow.
"Is there an anchor?" she shouted. "Where's the damned anchor?"
From the stern, the handmaid yelled back,
"How should I know?"
Shurk saw her crew now plunging into the shallows.
"Good."
"We're drifting back to that reef,"
the handmaiden cried.
"How do I stop it doing that?"
"With a damned anchor, you stupid cow!"
Failing to find anything and feeling somewhat bad about her outburst, Shurk turned about and began making her way back to the stern. One clear look at the handmaiden stopped her in her tracks.
"God's woman, what happened to you?"
"It's the damned voles," she snarled. That thing, is that what you call a sea anchor?"
Shurk forced her eyes away from the woman to where she was pointing.
"Male's kiss, aye it is."
5 quick steps along, she halted yet again.
"Is that water I'm hearing below? Are we taking on water?"
The handmaiden leaned on the rudder's handle and looked over with red-shot, exhausted eyes.
"You're asking me, Captain?"
Shurk whirled, reached the landward gunwale, glared down at her thrashing crew.
"Get aboard, you lazy pigs! Man the pumps, fast!"
Back on shore, Falash settled down on the log, careful once more to avoid the iron spikes. Drawing on her hookah, she watched the antics with some contentment. As she exhaled a stream of smoke, she heard and felt a rattle in her throat. Almost time for her afternoon cough. He kicked his way through the clutter, the crumpled helms, the crushed iron scales, the bones that crumbled into dust and lifted grey clouds to swirl about his legs. Ahead, across an expanse of level land buried in corpses, was a mound of the same twisted bodies, and from the top of that mound rose the trunks of two trees, bound at the center to form an upright X. The remnants of a body hung from it, flesh in shreds, black hair hanging down over the desiccated face. Silchas Ruin could see, even from this distance, the long shafted arrow buried in the figure's forehead. Here, in this place, realms folded one upon another. Chaos and madness in such profusion as to stain time itself, holding horror in an implacable grip. Here the skin of 100 worlds bore the same seared brand. He did not know what had happened at this battle, this slaughter, to leave such a legacy, nor even the particular world in which the actual event had taken place. He slowly crossed the killing field towards the mound and its grisly shrine. Other figures moved about, walking as if lost, as if seeking friends amidst the faceless thousands. At first he'd thought them ghosts, but they were not ghosts, they were gods. His passage caught the attention of one, and then another, and then still more. Some simply looked away again, resuming whatever it was they were doing. A few set out to intercept him. As they drew closer, he heard their voices, their thoughts.
A stranger, interloper, this is not his world. This is not his curse. This is nothing to him.
He comes to mock us. The fragments of us snared here.
He does not even hear the cries that so deafen us. All these chains of desire. And despair, Shedinul. So much despair.
Silchas Ruin reached the base of the mound, studied the twisted bodies before him, a steep slope of solid bone, leathery flesh, armor and shattered weapons. A half dozen gods gathered around him.
Tist Leo son? No, Beru. Tist Andi. His white skin mocks the darkness within him.
Does he belong in the war? He is dangerous. We don't want him anywhere near us when we slay the fallen one, when we feed and so free ourselves.
Free? Growled one in a thick, heavy voice. Maori, from the legacy of our followers, we shall never be free. This is the bargain we made. I made no such bargain, Decembre.
Nevertheless, Beru, mortal desire gave us shape. Mortal desire dragged us into all their realms. It was not enough that we ascended, not enough that we should seek out our own destinies. I tell you, though most of me still walks a distant world, and his howls of betrayal deafen me, in curse and prayer I am knotted here like a fist. Do I desire worship? I do not. Do I seek ever greater power? I have been shown its futility, and now all my purpose settles like ash upon my soul. Here we are trapped, and so we shall remain. Because that fool master sanctified Kaminsald's theft. The fallen one was wounded, made useless with pain, and with that master's cursed blessing he raised the House of Chains, and with those chains he bound us all.
Decembre snorted.
Long before the first rattle of those chains, we were in shackles. Though we amused ourselves by pretending that they did not exist, the master of the deck and the fallen one dispelled the illusion. No, they dispelled our delusions. And with them all their sweet, precious convenience.
I do not need an upstart like you telling me all I already know.
You do, when you would feed your reason with false indignation. We shall soon gather in another place, little different from this one, and there we shall commit murder, cold, brutal murder. We shall slay a fellow god, before his heart is sundered, before the unknowable woman can ever reach the fallen one, or attempt whatever it is she intends, we shall kill him.
Do not so easily discard that woman, Decembre,
said a new voice, a woman's, thin and crackling.
She is sibling to the master of the deck, a master who hides himself from us all. How can this be? How has he managed to blind us to his whereabouts? I tell you, he hovers over all of this, as unknowable as his sister. This wretched family from that wretched empire.
A cane crackled against bones, splintering them, and Silchas turned to see that a new god had arrived. Indistinct, a smear of shadow.
Decembre, this one hissed. And dearest Jess, Beru, Shedenul, Maori, Bekra, Thilander, see how you crowd this Tist Andy. This brother of Anomander Rake? Do you imagine he cannot hear you?
The cane jabbed at Decembre.
Look at us, so fey in reflection of our once mortal selves. The Empire, yes, our Empire, Decembre, or have you forgotten? That wretched family? Our very own children.
Oh, look around, Shadow Throne,
snarled Jess, her face of skeined wool, cotton, hemp, and silk, twisting and knotting as she bared web-shrouded teeth.
The wreck has come and gone from this place. She knows and makes for us a true path. Your damned children cannot hope to defeat us. Leave them to the Fokru Asael. May they devour each other!
Shadow Throne giggled.
Tell me, Jess, do you see your cousin anywhere near? Where is the Queen of Dreams in this place of death? She hides! She is not here, Jess,
said Shadow Throne,
because she is awake. Awake! Do you understand me? Not sleeping, not dreaming herself here, not plucking all your mad tales, Jess, to confuse mortal minds. You are all blind fools.
You mean to betray us?
Shrieked Shedinul.
I care nothing for any of you,
Shadow Throne replied, with a laconic gesture of one ethereal hand.
Betray? Too much effort over too little of worth.
You come here only to mock us?
I am here, Beru, because I am curious. Not about any of you. You're nothing but gods, and if the Asael succeed, you will all vanish like farts in the wind. No, my curiosity is with our unexpected guest, our Tist Andy.
The cane waved at Silchus Ruin.
Oh, brother of heroes, why do you bless Coltane's eternal fall with your presence?
I seek a weapon.
The two you carry are not enough.
For a companion. This battle you all seem so eager to join, I could warn you against it, but I admit that I see little use in that. You are all determined to join the fray, leaving me to wonder.
Wonder what?
Demanded Beru.
When the dust settles, how many of your corpses will I see upon that field?
Silchas Ruin shrugged. Do as you will.
Your brother slew our strongest ally.
He did. And of what significance is that to me, Beru?
You are as infuriating as he was. May you share his fate.
We shall all share his fate, Silchas Ruin replied. Shadow Throne giggled.
I have found you a weapon, but only if the one who wields it is worthy.
Silchas Ruin looked round. From this place?
No, not from here. There is nothing to the weapons here but memories of failure.
A sword appeared from the shadows, swirling round the god and clattered at the Tist-Andi's feet. Looking down, he drew a sharp breath.
Where did you come by this?
Recognize it?
A hust.
But no, he hesitated.
I feel that I should, knowing well that sacred forge. The draconic theme is distinctive, but the ferules remind me of hust's earliest period of manufacture, and I thought I knew all of those so made. Where did you come by this?
Of little relevance, Prince. You note the draconic theme, do you? What is the term? Pattern weld? So you might think, to see those scales glittering so prettily along the length of the blade.
He giggled.
So you might think.
This weapon is too good for the one I intended to arm.
Indeed, how unfortunate. Perhaps you could convince your friend to take the ones you now wield. And for yourself, this singular weapon. Consider it a gift to you from Shadow Throne.
And why should you so gift me? Silchas Ruin asked.
Perhaps the others here bemoan the loss of Hood. I do not. He was hoary and humorless and ugly besides. Thus, if I cannot convey my best wishes to Hood's noble slayer, then his brother shall have to do.
Silchas Ruin looked back down at the hust sword.
When we were children, he muttered, he used to steal my things all the time because he liked to see me lose my temper.
He paused, remembering, and then sighed.
Even then he was fearless.
Shadow Throne was silent. The other gods simply watched.
And then, Silchas Ruin whispered, he stole my grief. And now what is there, I wonder? What is there left to feel?
If I suggested gratitude, would that be insensitive?
Silchas Ruin shot the god a sharp look and then said,
I accept the gift, Shadow Throne, and in return I offer you this.
He waved at the other gods.
This mob ill suits you. Leave them to their devices, Shadow Throne.
The god cackled.
If I was bloodkin to this family, I'd be the uncle slumped drunk and senseless in the corner. Luckily, dare I risk that word, I am not kin to any of them. Rest assured I will humbly heed your advice, Prince.
Silchas Ruin picked up the weapon. He looked at the gods, his crimson eyes slowly moving from one ghastly face to the next, and then he vanished. Desembre wheeled on Shadow Throne.
What was all that? What scheme are you playing at?
Shadow Throne's cane snapped out, caught the Lord of Tragedy flush across the bridge of his nose. He stumbled back, fell onto his backside. Shadow Throne hissed and then said,
the best part of you wanders the mortal world, old friend. Long ago, he surrendered that emptiness called pride. At last, I see where it fetched up. Well, it seems one more lesson in humility shall find you.
He glared at the others.
All of you, in fact.
Beru growled.
You snivelling little upstart!
But then his voice fell away, for the Lord of Shadows was gone.
Busy, busy, busy.
Cotillion paused on the road. It's done?
Of course it's done.
Shadow Throne snapped and then grunted.
Here? What are we doing here?
Recognize the place, then.
Pah! Not more regrets from you. I'm sick of them.
I am marking this site one more time.
What, like a hound pissing against a fence post?
Cotillion nodded. Crude, but apt.
What have you?
Shadow Throne demanded.
Did you return to Shadow Keep? Did you send her off? Did she need a few slaps? A punch in the nose? A quick Roger behind the keep?
She needed only my invitation, Amanas.
Truly?
Of all the wolves on one's own trail, Cotillion said, there is always one, the pack's leader, cruel and relentless. Show me a god or a mortal with no wolves on their heels.
Enough talk of wolves. This is me, after all. Fanged, eyes of fire, foul fur, and endless hunger. 100 beasts, each one named Regret.
Just so, Cotillion nodded.
So you put her on a horse and gave her a blade and sent her back down her own trail.
To kill the biggest, meanest one, aye. Shadow Throne grunted again.
Bet she was smiling.
Find me a fool who'll take that bet, Cotillion replied, smiling himself. The Lord of Shadows looked round.
See none hereabouts? Too bad.
The air filled with the cries of gulls.
Tist Leosan, the children of Father Light. A star is born in the dark, and the heavens are revealed to all.
Withal ran his hand along the pitted plaster, fragments of damp moss falling away where his fingers scraped it loose. The painted scene was in a primitive, awkward style, yet he suspected it was more recent than those glorious works in the city's palace. Light like blood, corpses on the strand, faces shining beneath helms, a sky igniting.
A few survived the chaos, the civil wars. They cowered here in this forest. In colored plaster and paint, they sought to make eternal their memories.
He wondered why people did such things. He wondered at their need to leave behind a record of the great events witnessed and lived through. Sure enough, a discovery like this, here in the forest above the shore, at the base of a vast sinkhole his errant step had inadvertently discovered, well, it led to questions and mystery, and, like the missing patches and the thick clumps of moss, he found a need to fill in the gaps.
For we are all bound in stories, and as the years pile up, they turn to stone, layer upon layer, building our lives. You can stand on them and stare out at future's horizon. Or you can be crushed beneath their weight. You can take a pick in hand and break them all apart until you're left with nothing but rubble. You can crush that down into dust and watch the wind blow it away. Or you can worship those wretched stories, carving idols and fascinating lies to lift your gaze ever higher, and all those falsehoods make hollow and thin the ground you stand on. Stories, they are the clutter in our lives, the conveniences we lean upon and hide behind. But what of it? Change them at will, it's only a game in the skull. Shaking the bones in the cup to see if something new shows up. I imagine such games are liberating. And the sense of leaving oneself behind is akin to moving house. A fresh start beckons, a new life, a new host of stories, a new mountain to build stone by stone.
What makes you happy withal?
Long stretches of time, sand, free of alarm.
Nothing else?
Oh, beauty, I suppose. Pleasure to caress the senses.
You play at being a solid and simple man withal. But I think it is all an act. In fact, I think you think too much about too many things. You're worse than me. And before long, all that chaos gets so thick it starts looking solid and simple.
Woman, you make my head ache. I'm going for a walk.
Rubbing at his bruised hip, he brushed twigs and mud from his clothes, and then carefully made his way up the sinkhole's side, grasping roots, finding footholds from the blocks of cut stone hiding in the gloom. Pulling himself clear, he resumed his journey down to the shore. 20 or more paces up from the strand, the forest edge had been transformed. Trees cut down, trenches dug in banked ripples facing the imminent breach in Lightfall. Figures swarming everywhere, weapons in heaps, swords, spears, and pikes, with shake and leathery crews busy scrubbing the rust from the ancient iron, rolling new grips from strips of soaked leather. The wood of the hafted weapons seemed to have been unaffected by the passage of time, the black shafts as strong as ever. Hundreds of helms formed vaguely disturbing mounds here and there, awaiting oil and refitting. Working his way past all this, Withal reached the strand. He paused, searching among the crowds, but he could not find the one he sought. Seeing a familiar face ahead, he called out, "Captain Pithy!" The woman looked up. "Where is he?" Withal asked. She straightened from the leather map she'd laid out on the sand, wiped sweat from her face, and then pointed. Withal looked in that direction, saw a lone figure seated atop an old midden, facing Lightfall. With a wave to Pithy, he set off in that direction. Yedan Derig was taking bites from a lump of cheese, his jaws working steadily as he studied the cascading light. He glanced over as Withal approached, but only briefly. Boots crunching on the ghastly white bone fragments of the beach and then the slope of the midden, where amidst larger pieces of bone there were husks of some forest nut, more recent gourds and pieces of pottery, Withal reached the prince's side, whereupon he sat down.
"I didn't know we had any cheese left."
Yedan plopped the last bit into his mouth, chewed a moment, swallowed, and then said,
"We don't."
Withal rubbed at his face.
"I expect to feel the salt, the freshened sea breezes. Instead, the air feels as close as the hold of a ship."
He nodded to Lightfall.
"There is no breath from this, none at all."
Yedan grunted.
"There will be soon enough."
"The queen was wondering about that."
"Wondering?"
"All right, fretting. Well, more like a cornered cat, come to think of it. So not fretting at all, snarling, all claws out, fear blazing in her eyes."
Yedan's jaws bunched, as if he was still chewing cheese, and then he said,
"Is that what you wake up to every morning, Withal?"
He sighed, squinted at Lightfall.
"Never been married, have you? I can tell."
"Not much interested."
"In any of that?"
"In the women."
"Ah. Well, among the Mekros, men marry each other all the time. I figure they see how men and women do it and want that for themselves."
"Want what, exactly?"
"Someone to be the cat, someone to be the dog, I suppose. But all official-like."
"And here I thought you'd go on about love and commitment, Withal."
"No, it's all down to who lifts a leg and who squats. And if you're lucky, that goes back and forth. If you're unlucky, you end up trapped in one or the other, and life's miserable."
"Your winning description of marriage, Withal, has fallen somewhat short for me."
"Sorry to hear that, Yedan."
"Something to do, I suspect, with the lack of sincerity."
Withal grinned.
"Anyway, the queen is eager for reassurance. Do you feel ready? And how soon?"
"There is no true measure of readiness until we are engaged, Withal. Until I can see what my army can do, or is willing to do. Of the two, I will take the latter and hope for the former.
As for how soon, he paused and then pointed at Lightfall. There, do you see that? A strange dull spot formed in the descending streams of light. It bled outward like a stain, reaching down to the very base before the brighter edges began soaking back in.
What was that?
Dragons, Weathall.
What?
Soul taken, or allies. The sorcery of the Elaint that some call their breath. They assail the barrier with that chaotic power, and with each breath the ancient wound thins, the skin weakens.
Mail save us, Yedan. You mean to stand against dragons? How?
When the wound opens, it will be at the base, to open the way for their foot soldiers. A beachhead will need to be established. We need to be driven back from the wound. For a dragon to physically come through the breach will take all of its power, and when it does, it will be on the ground, not in the air. And when a dragon is on the ground, it is vulnerable.
But if the beachhead has driven you back,
we must in turn overrun them.
To reach that first dragon?
Yes.
And kill it?
Ideally, halfway through the wound, and not killed, but dying. At that moment, my sister and the witches need to pounce, to take that draconic life force
and seal the breach.
Yedan Derig nodded. Withall stared at the man, his angled profile, his dark, calm eyes fixed so steadily upon Lightfall.
Beru's sweet piss, does nothing rattle him? Prince Yedan Derig, your soldiers will look to you, and now at last I begin to see what they will see. You are their own wall, their own Lightfall. But are you wounded too? Yedan, can it be done, what you describe?
The man shrugged. My sister refuses to kneel before the first shore. It is the act that sanctifies the Queen of the Sheik, and she will not do it.
Why ever not?
His teeth bared in a brief grin, Yedan said, We are a contrary lot, us royals. A queen who defies sanctification, a prince who will never produce an heir, and what of Awakening Dawn? What of our Sister of Night? Gone, forever gone. Yan Tovis and me, we are all that's left. Have you ever been in a Lethary city, Withall?
Well, yes.
Have you ever seen a sheik walk through a Lethary crowd?
No, I don't think so.
They keep their eyes on the cobbles. They shift and slide from anyone in their path. They do not walk as would you, tall, filling the space you need.
I believe that has changed, Yedan. What you and your sister have done here.
And sticking a sword in their hand and telling them to stand here, to fight and to die without a single backward step, will turn mice into snarling leopards? We shall find out the answer to that soon enough.
Withall thought for a time on all that the prince had said, and then he shook his head.
Is it just your royal blood, then, that makes you and your sister the exceptions to the image you paint of the sheik? You are not mice.
We trained as officers in the Lethary military. We considered that a duty, not to the king of Lether, but to the sheik. To lead, we must be seen to lead, but more than that, we needed to learn how to lead. This was the Lethary military's gift to us. But it was a dangerous one, for it very nearly swallowed up Yan Tovis. Perhaps it has, given the reluctance she now displays.
If she does not kneel to the shore, asked Withall, can the witches alone seal the wound?
No.
And if there were more of them?
Yedan glanced over. If I hadn't murdered them, you mean?
He seemed to find something left over in his mouth, worked it loose with his tongue, chewed and swallowed.
Hard to say. Possibly, possibly not. Venal rivalries plagued them. It's more likely they would have usurped my sister or even killed her. And then they'd set about killing each other.
But couldn't you have stopped them?
I did. Withal was silent for a moment, and then he said,
Surely she understands the danger.
I imagine so.
You've not tried to persuade her?
In her own way, my sister is as stubborn as I am.
Another wall,
Withal muttered. What? He shook his head.
Nothing of import.
There, another pass comes. Look. A dark shape was descending behind Lightfall, a thing huge and blurred, lunging to sweep past the heart of the wound. Something struck the barrier like a massive fist. Light sprayed like blood. Red cracks spread out from the dark stain. Yedan stood. Go back to the Queen of Carcanus, Withal, he said, drawing his sword. One more pass, if that, and then this begins.
Begins?
Withal asked, as if struck dumb. He saw Pythian Brevity running up the strand. A sudden chill flooded through him. Terrible memories of his younger days, of battles upon the decks of the Mekros. Fear weakened his legs. Tell her, continued Yedan, his tone as steady as ever, we will hold as long as we can. Tell her, Withal, that once more the sheikhs stand upon the shore. Spear points thrust out from the wound, a shivering, bristling horror. He could see figures pushing, crowding, could almost hear their howls. Light spurted like ropes of gore. Light flooded out onto the strand, illuminating the crushed bones. Light lit faces beneath helms.
Tist Leosan, the children of Father Light. A star is born in the dark, and the heavens are revealed to all.
Go, Withal. We are breached.
We can hold against nothing. We can only crumble like sand before the devouring wave. Yedan calls to his officers. His officers rush and shout. Ranks form up. These would-be soldiers struggle and steady themselves. The sheikh, my sheikh, stand pale, eyes wide, straining to see what's happening at the breach, where the Lethari, dreaming of riches, meet the thrusting spears. Screams now rise from the wound. There are Tist Leosan, their faces broken masks of fury, and all the madness of war is down there at the breach. Life's blood even now spilling down. We cannot hold. Look at my people, how their eyes track my brother now. But he's only one man, and even he cannot defeat this enemy. Long ago, there were enough of us, enough to hold, enough to last and to die to save this realm. But no longer.
Pullian's squish loomed in front of her. They were shouting, screaming, but she was deaf to them. The clash of weapons grew desperate, like a thousand knives upon a single whetstone.
But you are flesh, my brother, not a whetstone, flesh.
You must kneel.
Yan Tovis frowned at the young woman before her.
Is it blood you want?
Eyes widened. She held out her wrists.
This?
You need to kneel before the shore.
No,
she growled.
Not yet. Go away. I'm done with you. The islanders are fighting. Go down to them. Kneel yourselves in the sand beside the wounded and the dying, both of you. Look in their faces and tell them it was all worth it.
Yan Tovis lunged forward, pushing them so that they staggered.
Go, tell them. You want me to kneel, to sanctify all of this? Shall I be yet one more ruler to urge my subjects to their deaths? Shall I stand tall and bold, shouting fierce promises of glory? How many lies can this scene withstand? Just how empty can words be?
Kneel,
she whispered.
Yes, everyone, kneel.
Chapter 9. I am fallen prey. There was a time when fangs sank deep, my body dragged, and flesh howled. Fear's face was cold with instinct's need. There was a time when strangers took me, and the unfamiliar whispered terror, and the shock of desires we could not expect lit eyes so like our own. There was a time when a friend twisted before my eyes, and all my solid faiths washed free underfoot, unknowing the world with new and cruel design. There was a time when kin drew the knife to sever sacred lore with red envy and red malice. The horror visits the heart of home. Do you see this journey? What began in shadows and dark distance has drawn ever closer. Now I am fallen prey to the demon in my soul, and the face twisting is my own, railing at failures of flesh and bone. The spirit withers, and I fall prey. We have listed a world of enemies, and now we fall prey. We fall prey. Faces of Fear, Fisher Kell Taff. Broken at last, the body slumps, and the spirit pulls free. The spirit wings away in flight, and the sound of its wings is a sigh. But this, he knew, was not always the case. There were times when the spirit staggered loose with a howl as broken as the body left behind. Too long inside tortured flesh, too long a sordid lover of punishing pain. The sound of his horse's hoofs was hollow, the creak of its tendons like the settling of an old familiar chair, and he thought of a warm room. A place heady with memories, threaded through with love and grief, with joy and suffering. But there was no pocket within him to hold tears, nothing he could squeeze in one fist just to feel the wet trickling down between his fingers, no gestures left to remind himself of who he had once been. He found her rotted corpse, huddled in the lee of a boulder. There were red glints in her hair, beneath wind-blown dust. Her face was tucked down, sunken cheeks pressed against the knees, as if in her last moments she sat, curled up, staring down at the stumps of her feet. It was all too far gone, he told himself. Even this felt mechanical, but disjointed, on the edge of failure. A measure of stumbling steps, like a man blind and lost, trying to find his way home. Dismounting, boots rocking as the bones inside them shifted and scraped, he walked to her, slowly sat down on the boulder amidst the creaks of tendon, bone, and armor. Broken-winged, the spirit had staggered from this place, lost even to itself. How could he hope to track it? Leaning forward, he settled his face into his hands, and, though it made no difference, he closed his one eye. Who I am no longer matters. A chair creaking. A small room acrid with wood smoke. Crows in the rafters. What mad woman would invite them into this place? The hunters have thundered past, and the wolf no longer howls. She has no breath for such things, not now. Not running as she must. Running. God's running. She knows it's no use. She knows they will corner her, spit her with spears. She knows all about hunting and the kill, for these were the forces of law in her nature. So too, it seems, for the ones pursuing her. And the woman in the chair, her eyes are smarting, her vision blurs. The chimney needs cleaning, and besides, the wild is dead, forever dead. And when next the hunters thunder past, their quarry will be on two legs, not four. Just so. Do you dream of me, old woman? Do you dream of a single eye, flaring in the night, one last look of the wild upon your face, your world? Gods below, I'm tearing apart. I can feel it. The horns sound their triumph. Slain, the beast's heart stills its mad race.
In her creaking chair, the old woman reaches up one hand and gouges out one of her eyes. It rests bloody in her palm while she gasps with pain. And then she lifts her head and fixes her one remaining eye upon him.
Even the blind know how to weep.
He shakes his head, not in denial, but because he does not understand. The old woman throws the eye into the fire.
To the wild! To the wild! All gone! Gone! Loose the wolf within you, ghost! Loose the beast upon the trail, and one day you shall find her.
Who are you?
Smell that? Wax in the fire! Wax in the fire!
What place is this?
This?
The chair creaks. She reaches up to her other eye.
Love lives here, ghost. The hold you have forgotten. The hold you all yearn to find again. But you forget more than that.
She pushed her nails into her other eye.
Where there is love, there is pain.
No, he whispered. There must be more to it than that.
He lifted his head and opened his eye. Wretched wasteland, a boulder, a huddled form.
But she threw it into the flames. Wax, wax in the fire.
Looking down, he studied the corpse beside him, and then he rocked to his feet, walked over to his lifeless horse, and pulled from the saddle a roll of sacking. Laying it out, he went back to her, lifted her gently from her snarled nest of greening grasses, onto the cloth, drawing up the edges and binding them tight, and then gathering the sack and slinging it across the horse's rump just behind the saddle before climbing astride the motionless mount. Collecting up the reins, Tok closed his remaining eye, then opened the missing one. The day's light vanished abruptly, a mass of bruised clouds climbing, billowing outward. A savage gust of wind bowed back the trees lining the north ridge, and a moment later rushed down the slope and up onto the road. Her horse shied and then quivered to the impact, and she hunched down over the saddle as the gale threatened to lift her from the animal's back. Driving her heels into its flanks, she urged her mount onward. She was still half a day from the city. The Warrens had a way of wandering, and gates could never be counted on, and this particular gate had opened a long, long way from where it had begun. Exhausted, filled with doubts and trepidation, she pushed on, her horse's hoofs cracking sparks on the cobbles. Some things could haunt a soul. Some things needed undoing. The toe of a boot searching ashes. But no, she'd gone beyond that. She was here, regrets like hounds at her heels. Thunder pounded, lightning flashed and sent jagged fissures of argent light splitting the black clouds. Somewhere behind her, a strike detonated on the road and her horse stumbled. She steadied it with a firm rein. The gusts of wind felt like fists pummeling the left side of her face and all down that side of her body. She swore, but could barely hear her own voice. The darkness had swallowed the world now, and she rode half blind, trusting her mount to stay on the road. And still the rain held back. She could taste it on the air, bitter with the salt whipped up from the seas beyond the ridge. Her cloak pulled loose from the thigh strings and snapped out, wild as a torn sail behind her. She shouted a curse as she was nearly yanked from the saddle. Teeth grinding, she forced her upper body forward once again, one hand holding tight on the hinged saddle horn. She'd ridden into the face of sandstorms. Gods, she'd damned near spat into the face of the whirlwind itself, but nothing like this. The air crackled, groaned. The road shook to the thunderous reverberations like the hoofs of a god descending. Howling now, giving voice to her fury, she drove her horse into a churning gallop, and the beast's breath snorted like drums in the rain, but the air was charnel hot, tomb dry. Another blinding flash, another deafening detonation. Her horse wavered, and then, muscles bunching, bones straining, it regained its purchase on the road. And someone was now riding beside her, on a huge, gaunt horse black as the sky overhead. She twisted round to glare at him.
"This is you?"
A flash of a grin, and then,
"Sorry."
"When will it end?"
"How should I know? When the damned gate closes."
He then added something more, but thunder smashed to splinters whatever he'd said, and she shook her head at him. He leaned closer, shouted,
"It's good to see you again."
"You idiot! Does he even know you're here?"
And to that question, his only answer was another grin. Where had he been? The man had ever infuriated her. And now here he was, at her side, reminding her of all the reasons she'd had the first time round for doing what she did. Growling another curse, she shot him a glare.
"Will this get any worse?"
"Only when we leave."
"Gods below, the things I'll do for love."
"North," the withered hag had said, her bent and broken visage reminding Torrent of an uncle who'd taken a hoof to the side of his face, crushing jaws and cheekbone. For the rest of his days, he'd shown to the world the imprint of that hoof, and with a twisted, toothless grin, he'd laugh and say,
"My best friend did this. What's the world come to when you can't even trust your best friends?"
And if the horse had outlived him, if his wife had not wept at his byre as a widow should, instead of standing dry-eyed and expressionless, if he'd not begun chasing little girls... Torrent shook his head. Any rider who called his horse his best friend already had a few stones knocked loose in his skull. For all that, Torrent found himself tending to his mount with a care bordering on obsession, and he grieved to see it suffer. Poor forage, not enough water, the absence of its own kind. Solitude weakened a horse's spirit, for they were herd animals as much as humans were, and loneliness dulled the eye.
"The desert glitters with death," continued Earl Arathiel. "We must go round it, north."
Torrent glanced over at the children. Absey had ventured a few strides onto the plain, returning with a shard of crystal that painted prisms up his bared arm. He held up his trophy, waved it back and forth as if it was a sword, and then he laughed. The twins looked on, their wan faces empty of expression. He had no skills when it came to children. Red Mask had set him to care for the all children that day long ago, knowing well his awkwardness, his discomfort. Red Mask had been punishing him for something. Torrent could no longer remember what, not that it mattered anymore. From where he had been, he'd seen the fall of the great leader. From where he had been, he'd witnessed the death of Toc Annister. It was a measure of human madness, he realized, that children should be made to see such things. The pain of the dying, the violence of the slayer, the cruelty of the victor. He wondered what the twins had seen since that night of betrayal. Even Absey must bear scars, though he seemed oddly immune to long bouts of sorrow. No, none of this was right. But then, maybe it had never been right. Did there not come to every child that moment when the mother, the father, loses that godlike status, that supreme competence in all things, when they are revealed to be as weak, as flawed, and as lost as the child looking on? How that moment crushes. All at once the world becomes a threatening place, and in the unknown waits all manner of danger, and the child wonders if there is any place left in which to hide, to find refuge.
"North!"
said Olar Athiel again, and she set off, limping, pieces hanging from her battered form. The two skeletal lizards scampered into her wake. He'd wondered where they'd been, since it had been days since he'd last seen them, but now the damned things were back. Torrent turned from his horse and walked over to the children.
"Absey and Starvey this time," he said.
Stavi rose and took her brother's hand, the one not gripping the shard, and led him over to the horse. She clambered into the saddle and then reached down to Absi. Watching her lift the boy from the ground and set him down on the saddle in front of her reminded Torrent of how these children had changed. Wiry, all fat burned away, their skins darkened by the sun, a newly honed edge of competence. Red Mask left me to guard the children, but they are gone now, all of them, gone. So I promised Setok to ward these ones. So bold that vow. And I don't even like children. If I fail again, these three will die. Story's calloused hand slipped into his own. He looked down to meet her eyes, and what he saw in them made his stomach twist. No, I am not your unflawed protector, not your guardian god. No, do not look at me like that. Let's go, he said gruffly. She could feel her power growing, her senses reaching out through stony ground, along the sodden sands of buried streams. Again and again she touched the signs of her chosen children, the Imas, and even those from the Erasal, who dwelt in the times before the Imas. And she could hear the echoes of their voices, songs lost to ancient winds now, there on the banks of extinct rivers, in the lees of hills long since worn down and eaten away. The tools were crude, it was true, the stone of poor quality, but no matter. They had lived in this place, they had wandered these lands.
And they shall do so once again. On us, Tulan, you refuse to understand what I seek for you and all your kin. Silver Fox has led so many away, far beyond my reach. But first sword, those who follow you shall find salvation. Heed not the summons of the First Throne. She may be a child of the Emperor, she may even stand in the shadow of secrets, but her power over you is an illusion. What urges you to obey is the stain of Logros, the madness of his desperation. Yes, you knelt before the First Throne, there with all the others, but the Emperor is dead. The Emperor is dead. Listen to me, Onos Tulan. Turn your people back. The path you are on shall see you all destroyed. Find me. Let us end this war of wills. First sword, see through my eyes. I have your son. I have your son.
But still he pushed her away. Still his own power seethed and roiled around him, raw with the force of Telan. She sought to force her way through, but his strength defied her.
You damned fool! I have your son!
She snarled, paused to glare back at the humans trailing her.
And what of your daughters, Onos? Shall I open their throats? Will that compel you? How dare you defy me? Answer me!
Nothing but the moaning wind.
Must I abandon them? Must I find you myself? Tell me, is your power sufficient to rebuff a dragon? I will come to you, First Sword, in the raging fire of Telas.
If you harm them, O Lorethiel, 1,000 worlds of Telas fire shall not keep you safe from me.
She laughed.
Ah, now you speak.
Do I?
The bonecaster hissed in fury.
You? Begone, you one-eyed corpse! Go back to your pathetic army of worthless soldiers.
Reach so with your powers, O Lorethiel, and there is no telling whom you might find. In fact, consider this a warning. You are far from alone in this land. There are wings in the darkness, and the morning frost holds in every droplet 1,000 eyes. On the wind, scents and flavors, and the breath of ice.
Oh, be quiet! I see what you're doing. Do you imagine me unable to hide?
You failed in hiding from me, a one-eyed corpse.
The longer you linger, she said, the more you lose of yourself.